This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the British songwriter, singer, bassist, and record producer Nick Lowe. In the 1970s, he helped move rock forward by getting it back in touch with its roots. As a member of the band Brinsley Schwartz, he was one of London's first pub rockers. As house producer for the new wave label Stiff, he produced the first albums by Elvis Costello and Graham Parker. In 1979, Lowe's own record, Cruel to Be Kind, made the American top 20. He recorded several solo albums in the 70s and 80s. His new record, Party of One, is his first in a couple of years. It was produced by guitarist Dave Edmonds, who used to play with Lowe in the band Rockpile. From Party of One, this is Nick Lowe's song, All Men Are Liars. Nicola, welcome to Fresh Air. All Men Are Liars, your new song. I have to compliment you on the line, do you remember Rick Astley? He had a big fat hit, it was ghastly. Was this a rhyme that you had been waiting to use for a long time?
Years and years. No, it just presented itself. You know, the song, is, you know, All Men Are Liars. I was really having a pop at that... A crappy old record that he had out, you know, that's never gonna let you down, never gonna tell a lie, never gonna be horrible, never gonna do anything revolting at all. And I thought that was really some poor stuff, you know. So I wasn't really having a go at Rick, I was having a go at his song, but it seems to work well, doesn't it?
Yes.
Astley and Ghastly, yeah.
Very good. You in the early 70s played with Brinsley Schwartz, the British band, and you were one of the first groups to actually play the pubs, and this was like considered the roots of pub rock. Can you explain to Americans why it was such a big deal to be playing in pubs?
God, what a great question. You know, that's a really great question, because it's darn near impossible to explain why it was such a big deal. At that time, in England, England's a tiny place, you know, as anyone who goes there will testify. So everybody knows everybody else, you know, especially in the music business. And at that time, the big thing was glam rock then, which nobody who liked music really cared for. It's just a fashion thing. That's all England's contribution to the music scene has been for the last, I don't know, 20 years or so. But the pub rock thing was started. It's just playing, getting back to basics, and playing in bars, so anyone could just walk in and get a bit of excitement going. But it's you know, you see it happening all the time in America, but in England it's kind of rare, you know. So that's why it's such a big deal, and so difficult to explain what it, you know, to Americans why it was.
You were also the house producer for Stiff Records, which in the 1970s was one of the first real new wave labels. You produced Elvis Costello's first records. You produced Graham Parker's first record. I'm trying to figure out what my question is here. What was your approach to producing? And I'm wondering if you felt that this was the start of something new, or if it just seemed like you know, business as usual to you.
Oh no! I was very reluctantly thrown into that, really. The only reason I got into producing was because of the three of us who started Stiff Records, which is myself, my manager, Jake Riviera, and his pal, Dave Robinson, I'd spent more time in the studio than the other two guys had. So I was automatically the house producer. I didn't really want the job, but that was, you know, I was designated that. But in fact, and I didn't know what I was doing, you know, at all. And in a way, that was why it worked, because the people that Stiff signed were all kind of oddballs, you know. So the fact that I didn't know what I was doing sort of only added added to the odd sound of those records. And I still don't, you know, I still don't know how to work the equipment or anything like that. But I what I do is sort of wave my arms around and tell a couple of jokes and things, and watch them do it, you know. And if with the engineers, if I get an engineer that I can talk to, you know, I can. I don't say to him, "Hey man, put a bit of 3.4 on channel 26." You know, I don't know anything about that. I'll go more sort of. Can you make it go a bit more, because it's just going zzz at the moment? Or, you know, I go, can you make it go jang, or can you make the drum go boing? Or, you know, I make noises like that, and if they're cool, they know what I'm talking about. If they don't, then we're not going to get very far.
I think this has been taken as your credo, but you once said that your approach to producing was bash it out now, tart it up later.
Yes. Well, I mean, you can't do that nowadays, you know. I mean, the same principle applies, you know. I think the same principle still holds good, you know, that you shouldn't worry too much about it. It'll take care of itself, you know. But, you know, you hear so many records nowadays that are, you know, as soon as they start, that you're not going to hear a single mistake on there. You know, there's going to be no human hand is going to be visible at all. Like, no humans had anything to do with it. And the vocal, you can tell, nobody can sing like that, like they do on records. You know, it's done line by word by word, in a painstaking and agonizing process. Now, I don't think that this business is that important, you know, to warrant spending the amount of money that a family of four could live on comfortably for a year, you know, in some Ponzi studio making some piece of old claptrap. I just don't see that it's that important. And when it's such poor stuff, you know, it's very, very poor. Most records, I think, I last about 4 minutes listening to the radio nowadays. I think it's rubbish, mostly.
Well, a lot of records really have become a producer's medium, and you start to feel like the singers are really interchangeable.
Yeah,
you know, like any
producers,
voice will do, you just plug in someone onto the voice track.
Well, they're not really producers, these people. You know, I don't think. They don't know anything about music. They're engineers who've learned how to type, basically, and they can type out, so they can probably rip you off a couple of faxes at the same time as they're doing the drum machine, you know. And this stuff just doesn't excite me at all. In fact, I don't dislike it. You know, it's I don't think anything about it. It just goes in one ear, and immediately out of the other.
Well, I want to ask you about songwriting, but first, let me reintroduce you. My guest is songwriter, bass player, singer, producer Nick Lowe, and he has a new record out called Party of One. Now, I want to play one of your songs that it's a great song. It's What's So Funny About Peace and Peace, Love and Understanding. I'd like to hear the story behind the song, if there is one, and how ironic or how serious you were about the meaning of the lyrics.
Let me see. I thought this song up in about 1973. It's quite an old song, and when I did it as a joke, really. It's so sort of pretentious, you know. I did it on purpose, this sort of, as I walk this wicked world, searching, you know, for this and that and the other. I thought it was kind of funny, you know, and then finish off with What's So Funny About Peace, Love and Understanding is the hook. And it was okay, you know, it was pretty good. But then Elvis Costello started doing it in, I don't know, the late 70s or early 80s. And he started doing it in his show, and he still does it. And I don't know, he put something into the words, into the performance of it, that made the words, even though I meant them as a joke, you know, it made them mean something, you know. And the song's sort of, I've changed my mind about the song. I think it's really pretty good now.
So do you sing it more seriously now when you do it yourself?
I think so, yeah. I think I do too, yeah. Maybe because I'm older or something like that, you know. I don't feel quite that it's quite such a joke or something, you know. But it's still it's still not as good as Jailhouse Rock.
Well, let's hear Nick Lowe's recording of What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. Nick Lowe recorded in 1974 with the band Brinsley Schwartz. How did you start writing songs?
Well, when I started, which was when I left home with a guitar case in my hand, Lord, which was in 1968, you had to write your own songs. That was the thing to do. You know, every group. You wouldn't get anywhere unless you had somebody in the group who could write their own songs.
This is the post-Beatle years.
Yeah, that's right. And so there was a lot of really crappy songs about. And I was sort of designated the songwriter of the group. And my initial efforts, you know, it takes a while for you to find your own style. So my initial efforts were really derivative. You know, I mean, I really can't listen to the first records that I did. I don't really listen to my own records at all much, really, but the first ones I definitely can't, because I can hear really obviously where I was getting my influence from. You know, I used to like The Band very much, and I rewrote their catalogue, you know, several times. The night they drove old Pixie down. very, very obviously. But then, you see, well, in the case of The Band, then I'd read an article about them, and they'd say that they liked Lee Dorsey, for instance, and I'd go, Lee Dorsey, now I know him. He did Working in a Coal Mine and Ride Your Pony from the 60s. Right, I'll check him out again. And I'd go and buy a Lee Dorsey album, you know, and think, yeah, this is great. Oh, I can hear how they got that idea and this idea from Lee Dorsey. And then I'd look and see, oh, it's produced by Alan Toussaint. And then I'd find another record, you know, Ernie K. Doe or someone like that, produced by Alan Toussaint. And then it'd be the Meters, and then the Neville Brothers, you know, and slowly you start hearing all this other stuff, and you get and your influences get more and more, not quite as refined, you know, more and more obscure, I suppose, if you like, and if you like that stuff, then you'll find your own style inside you. The main thing is that you've got to accept what you are. When you start off, you have this preconceived idea of what you are. You know, I mean, I thought I was this sort of bad dude from, you know, from the swamps, you know, which I'm patently, I'm not. You know, I'm a white middle-class English kid, you know, or was a kid, you know. But and once you accept that, then you can get on with it. You know, once you accept what you are, then you get your own style going, and you can relax about it.
When you started, as you say, accepting who you were, did the kinds of songs you were writing change?
No, I don't think so. I've been singing the same song basically since I started. You know, when I was a real kid, the nearest you could get to rock and roll on Forces Radio, because my dad was in the Royal Air Force, and so I lived wherever he was stationed. You know, which is mainly in the Middle East. So I used to listen to Forces Radio. And at that time in the 50s, you know, it was very, very, you know, it was all Rosemary Clooney and Perry Como and that, yes. Which, as a matter of fact, the first record I bought was Magic Moments by Perry Como. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. Still do, as a matter of fact. I still think that's wild. But The nearest you could get to any kind of rock and roll stuff was a fellow called Lonnie Donegan. And he used to do... he had this sound, he's called his skiffle sound, which was, heavy acoustic, just thumping acoustic guitars and a real simple bass and drum line. And washboards, he plays washboard thing, you know.
Now, I think there's a couple of hits Americans would remember, like, did your chewing gum lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight? Did they do Rock Island Line too?
That's right, you got it. Yeah, Rock Island Line, Cumberland Gap. He used to do a lot of sort of Big Bill Brunsey things and Ledbetter songs. I learned all his stuff, and I still really, that's still the same sort of thing I do now, really.
I have always wondered why so many British rockers have been so influenced by Lonnie Donegan, because the records by him I know are Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavor on the Bedpost Overnight, which I think is really just an atrocious record.
Yeah, yes, that was a bit later on. Extremely amusing to English people, but total. Was that a hit over here, really?
Yeah.
Good grief. No, that was awful. But his early stuff was really great.
You know how you said that you're still writing the same song and these are songs mm-hmm. influenced by the Lonnie Donegan days?
Yeah.
Choose a song on the new record that you think is obviously influenced by that.
By Lonnie Donegan?
By the early stuff that you're listening to there.
Oh, I think most of it is, actually, on the new record. But an obvious example would be... Who Was That Man?
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know what song I hear in that?
What?
You know, Children Go Where I Send Thee?
Wait a minute. I think I do, yeah. It's a sort of a spiritual thing,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. That's quite unconscious.
Uh-huh.
Quite unconscious, but great.
Okay.
That's not a bad place to get something from.
So let's listen to Who Was That Man from your new record, Party of One.
Who was that? Who was that man? Nobody knows all across this land. Was that an unknown man? Who was that? Who was that man? It was a wild and wet November night, and the rush hour was at its height. Kings crossed the venue that the finger of death was pointed at. Among the crowd was a lonely soul with a mission in mind. To go. Nobody knows where he was bound when his fateful steps took him underground. Who was that? Who was that man? Nobody loved him all across this land. Was that an unloved man? Who was that? Who was that man? Through the open gates.
Is this record more of a return to folk in your musical background than previous records have been?
I don't think so. I think doing touring with Elvis Costello, mm-hmm. he encouraged me to go on tour with him playing acoustically, you know. And I didn't think I could do it, but he really kind of bullied me into it, you know. And I'm really glad he did, because if you stand up on the stage with an acoustic guitar in front of a few people, you soon can tell, you know, if your stuff is happening or not. And it put me back in touch with my own songwriting thing, which I'd lost sight of a little bit. And if folk music means something that you can just rip off on a guitar, then yes. But the thing is that I was listening to some of my old records to try and get an act together, you know, trying to think, well, which one shall I do in this act? I had to relearn them again. You know, I couldn't remember how they went. I found that some of the best records I'd made were some of the worst songs, like I Love the Sound of Breaking Glass, for instance, is a record of nothing very much. It's a good record, but there's nothing very much there in a song-wise, you know. Whereas a song like Raining, I listened to that and went, oh, man, you just recorded this all wrong. You know, the song isn't there, you know, the way it's been recorded. In other words... There, you can record a song or make a record, Do you see that there's a subtle difference there?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of records that are really great records because of the way they're produced, because of the way the singer sounds, but the song is pretty insubstantial. It's not one you'd want to pick out yourself. Yeah.
Like Let Me Take You to Funky Town by Lip Sync. You know, that was a really great record, that was, but there's not very much of a song there.
Right. One of your American releases has a great title, A Pure Pop for Now People. And what is the meaning of pop to you? How has that word changed to you over the years?
Well, popular music is stuff that sells, you know, which patently mine doesn't. You know, the stuff I do is still kind of a secret in the great scheme of things. But the stuff I suppose what I'm known for being a sort of pop guy is because I'm a fan, you know, really, and I sort of imitate the. Or at that time, anyway, I was sort of imitating what people's perception of pop music was, which is like, you know, real throwaway fluff, you know, just rejoicing in its disposability, you know. It always reminds me of sort of like cornflakes ads, you know, jingles on the TV, you know, real disposable stuff. And I like that.
Nick Lowe, his latest album is Party of One. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.